Chapter 6. What do you say? Fuels of the camp system. Questions. How do we stop kidding ourselves, even lying to ourselves in negotiations? How do we preclude or correct misunderstandings? How do we identify the real issues and problems? How do we stop adversaries from hedging, fudging, and outright lying to us? How do we make deals that stick? How do we answer truthfully without destroying the feelings of someone else? We use the specific goals of behavior and action, goals we can control, that I call the fuels of the system. These are the behavioral habits that allow us to peel the onion of the adversary's business situation and negotiating position and find out what's really going on over there. The single most important fuel that you have, the most important behavioral goal and habit you can develop, is your ability to ask questions. The other fuels, which I introduce in the following chapter, support our questions. Perhaps this seems like a small, maybe even quirky subject for a chapter. In the first place, it's a short chapter, and in the second place, it may be quirky, and it's certainly overlooked in every other book on negotiating I've ever seen. But the unwillingness or inability to ask good questions is a serious weakness in the field. They deserve their own chapter, believe me. If you master the art of questioning, your work as a negotiator will benefit enormously. For many of us, the problem with questions is that we have been trained in our respective educational settings to be the smartest person in the room. How do we accomplish this? By answering questions, of course. Very few of us are trained to ask them, and even those whose professional work depends on this skill, I'm thinking of doctors and lawyers now, often don't do a very good job at it. Doctors can be so constrained by time and bureaucratic formulas and so dependent on laboratory tests that they forfeit one of their key diagnostic tools, asking good questions. I've had first-hand experience with this kind of medicine. I've also had the equivalent experience with lawyers, and I don't mean just in the courtroom where the exchanges are tightly controlled by rules, but even in depositions where the parties can take more liberties. The doctor is trying to understand her patient's case. The lawyer is trying to find out as much as she can about the testifier's knowledge of the case, and the negotiator must try to see and understand her adversary's world. In any negotiation, where do we want to spend as much time as possible? In the adversary's world. If this wasn't your answer, that's okay, but it's the one I'll be looking for by the time we finish this book. Your mission and purpose is set in your adversary's world. Starting with M&P and going from there, you want to inhabit the adversary's world, because that's the world about which you need information, and that is the perspective from which the adversary makes decisions. He doesn't make decisions from your perspective, does he? Of course not. He makes them from his own perspective, obviously. How do you find out about this perspective? How do you inhabit his world? By asking questions. As I've already discussed, our decisions are initially 100% emotional. After we've made our emotion-based decision, we need time to get the clear picture, the clear vision with which to rationally judge that decision. Questions are the means by which the negotiator helps the adversary do this. The adversary's answers to our questions build the vision that he needs to make decisions. No vision, no real decision. This is a rule of human nature. The most pliable win-win folks won't buy a 10-cent trinket without some kind of vision of themselves or their children playing with this trinket, right? Now, if you have any doubt about this point, please take a moment to think about it. It's some vision in our mind's eye that leads us to buy this house, to plant this flower, to negotiate this deal. All of us make decisions based on the vision we have of the issue at hand. No vision, no decision. It's vital that you understand this point. As a negotiator, questions are the fuels we use to lead the adversary to a vision that will serve as a catalyst for a decision. As much as possible, we want the negotiation to stay in our adversary's world. Questions do serve the further purpose of helping us control our own neediness and to be un-okay, and this is a valuable purpose, I hope you'll agree. But the vital purpose of questions is to allow us to move around in the adversary's world and see what they see, and then lead them to a clear vision and decision as well. The Power of Correct Questions. Asking questions is a science and an art. The science is in how you intellectually construct a question. The art is found in how you ask it, the tone of your voice, your creative choice of words, your behavior and remarks before asking your question. So now we're going to get pretty technical, and we have to because technique is everything here. First, the science. In the construction of our questions, we can start with a verb or an interrogative. The verb-led question is just that, a question that begins with a verb. Is this something you should do? Can you do this? Will you do this? Do you need this? Do you have 5 minutes to see me? How many responses can such questions bring? Off the top, the majority of my new clients and workshop students say 2. I wish it were so, but the correct answer is 3. Yes, no, maybe. I hope you remember the discussion of these 3 choices in Chapter 3, Start with No, and why, for a negotiator's purposes, maybe tells you nothing at all, and yes is even worse. Only no tells you something real, gives you something to go on with your next question. With only 1 worthwhile answer out of 3, it follows that verb-led questions are often a waste of time. Therefore, there are only 2 reasons to ask such a question. If you already know the answer, law students are taught just this rule, or if you're near the very end of the negotiation and you have to really bore in. The answer to the verb-led question usually does not give you worthwhile information. That's one problem. Another problem is that such a question can often seem to the adversary as if you're driving for a yes. Can you do this? Is a perfect example. The question seems to the adversary to be calculated to take away the right to answer no. It seems subtly manipulative, and usually it is subtly manipulative. Most people don't really want to say no in the first place, as we've discussed, so if your question makes it even harder for them to do so, you've created an uncomfortable, defensive adversary, and this does you no good at all. Questions are so, so subtle. Consider the difference between the following choices. Is this what you really want? Isn't this what you really want? Both are verb-led and therefore dubious, but the inclusion of the word not makes the second question a really terrible one because of the insinuated rush to close. Remember, no closing. Sooner or later in the negotiation, the attempt will backfire. Can you say yes to this? This is another terrible verb-led question. Never frame a question that seems to the adversary to be taking away the right to say no. Is there any reason you wouldn't say yes to this? Even worse, if that's possible. Never frame a question that appears to your adversary as an attempt to trick. Everyone reading this book would flinch when hearing that question. And yet, they do hear that question or the equivalent all too often from inexperienced negotiators. This point must be clear. Framing any question is very tricky and very important. You can blow a solid 1-hour presentation in less than 1 minute with an ill-chosen one-sentence question such as, "Is there any reason you wouldn't say yes to this?" But it happens every second of the day somewhere, because the ill-trained negotiator has been led to believe that he's supposed to ask such a question in order to push things along quickly. But what if I were to ask this question? What would you like me to do? Well, this simple question is of a different sort altogether. This question spawns some interesting dynamics. Mainly, it's a very comforting question to hear. It demonstrates that you, the negotiator who has asked this question, has no needs at the table. You've opened an area for negotiation and shown no fear. You're making no assumptions. The adversary feels okay because you're at her service. You're certainly not closing, attempting to confuse, or any of that negative stuff. And hearing this question, the adversary on the other side of the table has no reason to fear you. Just as important, this open-ended question does not have a quick answer. It cannot be answered with yes, no, or maybe. The necessarily more extended answer will have, well, may have, some information, or some emotion, or some telltale waffling, or some insight. It should have something you can work with, because as we know, people have a weakness for talking. Who has control in a conversation? The guy listening or the guy talking? The listener, of course. If you want to maintain maximum control and leverage, and you do, of course, let your adversary do the talking. With a question such as, "What would you like me to do?" you invite the adversary to indulge this weakness. Moreover, her answer allows you to enter her world and her vision. Likewise, when I ask, "How are you?" whose world am I entering? Whose world am I entering when I ask, "Now, why did you invite me to this meeting?" Whose world when I ask, "What's the biggest challenge your company faces?" Have you noticed the main difference between these good questions and any of the previous bad questions? The good ones are led by an interrogative, not by a verb. Who, what, when, where, why, how, and which? These are the famous interrogatives we all learned about in elementary school, I guess. They begin the safe, effective questions in a negotiation. They'll move the negotiation forward without the pitfalls of verb-led questions. You have to be diligent and careful with all questions, with every word you utter. But the verb-led questions are almost all downside, while the interrogative-led questions are a key means of discovery. They elicit details. They ensure thoroughness. They help the adversary as well as us see what hasn't been understood before. I'm sure you didn't register, there's no reason you should have, that the first sentence of my introduction was an interrogative-led question. How often over the past couple of decades have we read or heard the phrase, win-win? My strategy was simple. In order to open your mind to my contrarian approach, I thought I needed to challenge immediately, right in the first paragraph, the reigning paradigm in negotiation, which is win-win. But in order to do this, I had to create in your mind a vision of its omnipresence in our culture. What better way to do this than with a question led by an interrogative? It's hard to go wrong with interrogative-led questions. Many readers have probably participated in role-playing games and workshops. They're pretty much a staple in the business world, and they really can be useful. So let's try one now. Close your eyes. Relax. Let your muscles go limp. You're allowed to be anywhere you'd like to be. You may be with anyone you choose, doing anything you'd like to do. Okay, let's play. Where are you? Whom are you with? What are you doing? Maybe you're somewhere in the tropics with a beach in the foreground, or maybe you're skiing down a mountain with a chalet and a hot toddy in the background. In any case, your ability to envision the scene will have a direct effect on your ability to help others gain a clear picture of what you would like them to see. This was your picture, your world, that I was finding out about through the use of interrogatives. In just this way, the interrogative-led question in a negotiation helps you turn on your adversary's picture tube. The interrogative-led question helps you help the adversary to turn on their own vision and to paint clear pictures so that both sides have the same picture. It gives you the power to see what they see, what you need to. Otherwise, there'll be no progress in this negotiation. Here's a set of verb-led questions juxtaposed with an equivalent interrogative-led question on the same subject. In every case, which is the better question? Is this the biggest issue we face? Versus, what is the biggest issue we face? Is this proposal tight enough for you? Versus, how can I tighten this proposal? Can we work on delivery dates tomorrow? Versus, when can we work on delivery dates? Or, how important are delivery dates? Do you think we should bring Mary into the loop now? Versus, where does Mary fit in? Or, when should we bring Mary into the loop? Is there anything else you need? Versus, what else do you need? Do you like what you see? Versus, what are your thoughts? Is it too expensive? Versus, what price would you pay? Does it fit into your needs? Versus, how do you see it? or where would you use it? This rule about interrogative-led questions is not rocket science. Negotiators have been taught for decades to ask open-ended questions, and interrogative-led questions are simply one type of open-ended questions. I emphasize the interrogative-led idea rather than the open-ended idea because I've found that the former rule is easier to understand and to follow in the heat of a negotiation. Interrogative-led questions can be closed, of course. What time is it? Is an example. But generally speaking, the negotiator who frames interrogative-led questions is on the right track. You might be thinking, well, okay, but this discussion is too simple and stagey. It doesn't sound very real-world to me. Does it really apply in the world of big-time negotiating? This is a fair question. Some of my examples have been a little stagey for the sake of simplicity and clarity. But now, let me list in order the sequence of questions asked in a phone call by a client working for a large corporation. His adversary worked for an even larger corporation. This was one of hundreds of such conversations, in person, on the phone, and by email, during the course of a long negotiation. The subject here is intentionally unclear, but for our purposes, the subject doesn't matter. Here are the questions. Why did your previous boss want you to get with me? Why were we added? Who was your old boss? How did that affect us? Where are we at in the process? What happened? Where will you be? Like what? How can I help you succeed? Who will pull all these factions together within the unnamed corporation? How should I work with unnamed? How should I proceed? What are unnamed company's plans at the facility in unnamed American City? What are the plans for the unnamed project? What influence does unnamed project have in all this? How should I proceed? Why are you asking? Who are they? I don't claim that I picked this conversation completely at random, but I assure you that it's quite typical. My clients really do live and die, mostly live, mostly thrive, by asking interrogative-led questions. One client was recently brought into a negotiation with a large multinational to be the competitive vendor for a primary vendor. We understood that this was the dynamic and accepted it, and we also knew that the primary vendor would have a powerful constituency within the multinational's own middle management, because some such liaison is almost a given. Such a situation must be addressed up front by any negotiator. We therefore framed the following question to ask at the highest possible level, CEO to Senior Vice President specifically. How do we keep our efforts from being sabotaged by someone within your company who is responsible for the competitor's success? In this instance, the answer was the Senior Vice President's instruction to the in-house spear carrier for the primary vendor to be certain that my client's efforts came to fruition. The man's annual bonus now depended on it. Think back a little bit more about mission and purpose. Remember the features and benefits to your adversary that we want to be part of our mission and purpose? Such features and benefits can also be part of your questions. The words that describe a feature or a benefit can be placed in the question to help the adversary see a problem. Say our rough-and-ready mission and purpose for this negotiation is to have Humongous Incorporated see and decide that having our technology will meet all their needs now and in the future. One good interrogative-led question to fit into an early discussion might be, how can you stay competitive without this technology? Notice the vital difference between that question and, can you stay competitive without this technology? The point of both questions is to lead the adversary to see that they cannot stay competitive otherwise, but the question led by the verb can sounds faintly accusatory and might put the adversary on the defensive. While the question led by the interrogative, how, is softer, less threatening, and more inviting of a straightforward, worthwhile answer. Once again, the advantage goes to the interrogative-led question. Let's return to the story in Chapter 2 about Network Incorporated, the company that needed to renegotiate the contract for its machines because each one was being sold at a loss. Say our mission and purpose for this negotiation is to help the other company's management at the very highest level see our company as a new and revitalized organization that's going to change its effectiveness. One good interrogative-led question to fit into an early discussion might be, how will you measure us from this point forward? Let's return to the infamous negotiation involving the baseball umpires, which we talked about in Chapter 4. Say their mission and purpose is, as I've already stated, to get the players, the fans, and the lords of the game to see and decide that the umpires provide the highest level of expertise in calling balls and strikes and plays at the bases while remaining invisible on the field. One good interrogative-led question to fit into an early discussion might be, how long does it take to develop a great umpire? Another might be, how many bad calls does it take to really hurt a baseball game? I urge you to play these hypothetical games because the power of the simple interrogative-led question is just amazing. I've had clients for whom this understanding was a eureka moment that turned around their whole careers as negotiators. Their appreciation of the difference between these disarming questions and all others seemed to loosen them up in a fundamental way. Their own neediness came under control. They now understood that a successful negotiation really does take place in the adversary's world, not in their own. They suddenly understood the necessity of creating vision in the adversary. No vision, no decision? Of course. And now I add, no interrogative-led questions, no vision, no decision. Keep it simple. Keep your questions short. Anytime a question has more than, say, 9 or 10 words, you risk complication. You may think that a lengthy compound question sounds impressive, but you're not in the business of sounding impressive, remember? Such a question serves only to kill vision and confuse your adversary. Remember when I said that if our own mission and purpose is too cloudy, we make it difficult for our adversary to make a decision? Well, the same thing goes with questions. Another key is to ask one question at a time. Simple question by simple question, answer by answer, you will help your adversary build his own picture of the issue. But often, we don't do this. A negotiation is a very emotional arena, of course, and we get impatient and load one question on top of another, asking 5 or 6 in a row, barely pausing to take a breath, much less letting the adversary answer. Instead, you must take each question slow and easy, and listen to each answer, because that answer is the clue for framing the next question. When is your ideal delivery date? How critical is this November date for you? I'm not sure I understand. Why is November so important? Oh, when did that problem on the production line show up? Interesting news. And it happens all the time, because mixed in with everything else in the answers to good questions will be some spilled beans. I discuss this phenomenon at length in Chapter 8. There seems to be a human impulse to help people answer our questions. We start off with a good interrogative-led question, but then answer it for the adversary, or at least throw out possible answers. I ask, what is the big challenge you face? And before you have a chance to answer, I add, is it the national economy or your local labor problems? One mistake on top of another. We answered the question for our adversary, and in doing so, our interrogative-led question turned into a verb-led question. All we accomplish with this intervention is to impede the process by which the adversary creates a vision for himself and for us regarding his company's greatest challenge. I've mentioned the clients for whom their sudden understanding of the power of interrogative-led questions was a eureka moment. For many others, the art of asking questions has become a standing challenge. They really get into it. They understand that asking great questions is an art, a science, and a necessary skill for succeeding at the highest level.